This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's issue, Laura Patel discusses whether the next refugee crisis emerging in Turkey could dwarf the first which has gripped Europe. Turkey has taken in 2.5 million refugees, nearly three times as many as the number who have sought refuge in Europe. But there are signs that the country is starting to struggle under the strain of Syrian refugees as more arrive each day. What could it mean for Europe if Turkey reaches breaking point? Joining Laura is Alana Thomas from think tank Migration Watch UK, who will be discussing the impact on Europe and Britain if Turkey's migrant problem becomes ours. Also in the magazine, The Spectator's political editor James Forsyth critiques the Prime Minister's assessment that, on the basis of his proposed package of renegotiation with Europe, he would join the EU right now. James argues that David Cameron's position seems odd, given that the inside's strongest arguments focus on the disruption Brexit would cause. Is David Cameron barking up the wrong tree? Joining him to discuss this is Spectator editor Fraser Nelson. And from big political questions to the biggest animals which have ever drawn breath on Earth, what is the basis of our fascination with whales? Simon Barnes says humans used to see the huge creatures as protein mountains and oil mines for hunting. But now, he writes, whales excite a widely held curiosity and delight. Our attachment to whales makes the number of the creatures being beached this year all the more tragic. With Simon is Dr. Peter Evans, director of the Sea-Watch Foundation, a charity which has been involved in the rescue efforts. So first up, what does the migrant crisis unfolding in Turkey mean for Europe? Every day in the country, the number of Syrian refugees grows larger. The scale is already overwhelming, and there are signs the Turkish government may halt its generous attempts to take in those fleeing the conflict in Syria. If that happens, and Turkey decides it can no longer cope, argues Laura Patel, their migrant problem quickly becomes ours. Should this be cause for concern? And is Europe doing enough to help Turkey? Migration Watch's Alana Thomas discusses with Laura, who joins us from Turkey, what the impact on Europe and Britain could be if the Great Migration really is just beginning. So Laura, just explain why Turkey can't cope with the number of refugees it's seeing at the moment.
I think that I arrived in Turkey about 3 or 4 months ago after moving here from London, and I was just really struck by how many refugees are here. You know, we in the British press, everybody is worrying and has been a lot over the last year about the numbers coming to Europe. And that's fine because a lot of people have been coming. You know, 1 million people is the estimate of refugees and migrants came to Europe in 2015. But from the Turkish point of view, of someone being here, I was just kind of staggered by how many people they've taken. Turkey has 2.5 million Syrian refugees, and that's just the Syrians. Like, there are others here as well. And so from the perspective of Istanbul, it's kind of shocking to see how much this country has done. They've been very generous, and Turkey has won a lot of praise internationally for its response. But life is hard here for Syrians. Like, until now, they haven't had the right to work. They often don't have access to healthcare or education. So families, they might have left a few years ago from Syria and thought, oh, maybe one day we'll be able to go back. But being here, looking longer term, they realise actually they can't go back, not anytime soon. And they don't have that many prospects here, or they haven't had in the past. And understandably, they end up looking to Europe. And I think Europe needs to be more understanding, really, about Turkey's position.
Alana, do you think Europe is being understandably not particularly understanding of Turkey's situation, given the effect it might have on other European countries of more refugees coming over?
Yes, of course. Europe is in a very difficult position. You know, politically, it is struggling. I thought the numbers coming into Europe was actually 1.8 million coming irregular crossings into Europe. And clearly, this is causing tension. So the European Union is clearly in a difficult position. And like Laura says, that Turkey has been incredibly generous. I can't sit here and say what the solution is. I think earlier on in the crisis, I think perhaps people were thinking that it's best to keep refugees in the area. I think that remains the case. Perhaps we need to start thinking about encouraging Turkey to let people work Because, you know, although this war is going on for a long time, wars do end. And we hope that one day Syrian people will be able to go back to Syria to rebuild their country. So I think, yes, Turkey has been very generous. Has Europe accepted that? I'm not sure. I can't say, really.
And Laura, at what point will we start to see more refugees coming from Turkey into Europe? You report in your piece threats from Turkish leaders to the EU. Can you see that changing into a deliberate policy of moving those refugees on?
No, I don't think so. But I think the EU has just struck a big deal with Turkey. It's a €3 billion package designed to keep the refugees here. One of the things that will happen under that, Turkey has said, is that Syrians will be given the right to work. They said last month in January that that would happen. And that could potentially make quite a big difference. The issue, Brussels is very unnerved by the fact that the numbers of people coming haven't really reduced. I mean, I will add here that everyone coming to Europe isn't a Syrian. About half of the people travelling across the Mediterranean are thought to be Syrian. The rest are Afghans, Iraqis and others. But the point that I make in my piece is that the biggest driver of refugee flows in the world is the conflict in Syria. And crucially, it's getting worse. Like, it's getting worse and worse and worse. Our listeners might have read about the offensive that's been going on in the northern Syrian province of Aleppo over the last few weeks. The Syrian government has been making gains there, backed by the Russian Air Force, and it's driven people towards the Turkish border. They're currently stuck there at the moment. When it's not clear what's going to happen to them, but whatever happens, I just can't see these numbers going down. The conflict in Syria is getting worse, and Elana might say, oh, the war will end, but no one really sees any sign of that. The UN's first attempt at peace talks in 2 years have basically collapsed before they've even got underway. Everything is getting worse, and there's no sign of it ending.
Elana, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I would agree with that. About 1.3 million applications have been lodged in 2015. About 28% of those are from Syria. You have an additional 14% from Afghanistan and 10% from Iraq. But see, that means that you have a large number of people, about half, who are coming from countries that are not affected by war in the Middle East. So I think one of the things that Europe needs to do is to discourage movements of people from countries where there is no conflict, countries such as Kosovo and Albania. And I think if the European Union can do that, it is then much more able to actually help with Syrian nationals who genuinely need refuge. So it's about making the distinction between economic migrants and asylum seekers. If we can identify those economic migrants and send them back to their countries because they have no right to claim asylum in Europe, then we would perhaps be able to help more Syrians, I think.
Laura, do you think that European countries should be doing more, and what in particular should they be doing more? You said earlier that they need to be more understanding, but what materially would that mean?
One of the things they need to do, in a way they're already doing, which is trying to encourage Turkey to do more to make life easier and more long-term sustainable for Syrians. So giving them the right to work so that they're not either forced to sit on their hands or work illegally for low pay and potential exploitation. It's about getting more healthcare services, more schools. But I do wonder, when European leaders say, oh, it's best for Syrians to stay in the region, it's best for them to stay where they are, I wonder who they really mean that it's best for. I can't help but think that they mean it's best for Europe. And I don't deny that it's causing a lot of tensions in Europe. You know, we're seeing the rise of far-right parties. We're seeing the whole concept of the Schengen zone of borderless travel in European countries, not Britain, I add. That whole system is coming under quite an existential threat. It's an impossible dilemma, really. And part of the reason that we're seeing this huge flow of people is to do with much bigger questions of globalization and differentials between wealth in different countries and the ease of travel that wasn't there But presumably, decades past.
Presumably for the Turkish population, if European leaders are saying, well, we need people to sort of, it's best for them to stay in the region, and you suspect that that may have as much to do with it being best for those who are already living in those European countries, presumably you're seeing tensions between those who are already living in Turkey and the large number of refugees who have recently arrived. If you're talking about better access to schools, better access to medical services, there is presumably an impact on the Turkish population as well.
It's really fascinating, actually, because as someone who comes from that European context coming here, I've been amazed how little very big tensions there have been. Like, you know, we haven't seen in Turkey big protests like the ones waged by the far right in European cities. There hasn't been like huge media hostility towards them. And in many ways, Turkey is very proud of what it's been doing. I still remember watching a news bulletin on the state broadcaster a few months ago where it contrasted split-screen images of like families of refugees slumped on an unnamed railway line somewhere in Europe compared to some like orderly tents where with great services and provisions in Turkey. But the big but is that when you talk to people, I find that they do initially say that they're very, you know, they're very glad and proud that Turkey is taking people. But there's always a kind of but of like, you know, we do worry about these people. We accepted them as guests, but how long are they going to stay? There are differences in culture and language, even though they're both kind of countries, they're neighbouring countries, they're quite different places, really.
Alana, why is it that European countries are finding it that much more difficult?
I think European Union countries are struggling at present with the scale of the movement. So you have a border, at the Greek border is not in any way secure, and you have 1.8 million people coming in. A million people have come to Germany. It's a large number of people to feed, to house, to process those asylum applications. It's extremely difficult. And I think the point that Laura makes, it actually underlines the importance of processing these applications quickly, deciding who needs refugee status, finding them places to live and give them the protection that they need. And for those that do not qualify for asylum, they have to be sent back to their home countries. And then we will actually be able to provide asylum to those people that need it. So I think it's really important to make that distinction between asylum seekers and economic migrants, between refugees and economic migrants.
Isn't the issue that with the conflict in Syria, there's more refugees being created than really the world, or at least Europe, can possibly handle? You know, Syria was a country before the war of 20 million people. Mm. We know there are at least kind of 4-5 million refugees outside the country and potentially loads more. And the world doesn't really know how to deal with that. I don't know what we do with no end to the conflict in sight, international powers not willing or able to bring an end to it. This is just going to keep going.
That was Laura Patel in Turkey and Migration Watch's Alana Thomas. Now, with so much at stake for Britain and for the Prime Minister himself in the upcoming EU referendum, has David Cameron got his argument for staying in right? The Spectator's political editor James Forsyth says Cameron is trying to cast himself as a pragmatist who has weighed up all the options before deciding it is worth staying in after all. But in suggesting he would choose to join the EU, even if Britain was not a member, James argues he is in danger of undercutting his own argument about the turmoil Brexit would cause. With James is Spectator editor Fraser Nelson. So James Forsyth, in the week and a half since David Cameron unveiled his deal in his EU renegotiation, how have things gone?
Not so well for the Prime Minister. We've had a YouGov lead with a YouGov poll with the biggest lead for out. We've got an ICM poll out today, which has out ahead for the first time since 2013. Now, look, you know, we all are meant to treat polls more sceptically since the general election, and this is a particularly difficult referendum to poll. But you can't claim that this deal has gone down well. The media have turned on it. It is pretty threadbare. Marina Wheeler, a very eminent lawyer, points out in The Spectator this week that there are all sorts of legal holes in it. So it doesn't feel like the momentum is with David Cameron and the In campaign, despite all the infighting on the outside. And when the Prime Minister makes claims about the idea that the Songat would end up in Folkestone if we left the European Union, it's been met with ridicule rather than treated seriously. I mean, if this is Project Fear, it doesn't appear to be scaring people at the moment.
Fraser, have you been surprised by the arguments that David Cameron is making?
I've been surprised by the quality of them. I really did expect that after 3 years of promising this referendum, he would be ready with some quite convincing ones when it came to the starting gun being fired. I mean, at the moment, I feel like I could make a better case for staying in the EU than he has been able to. I mean, nobody seriously believes that if we pull out of the EU, then there's going to be a transfer of the migrants in Songat to Dover, and nor the other campaigns. It reminds me of the Scottish referendum, where they tried to come up with things that sounded so implausible and scary, but it backfired. It began to insult the intelligence of the average voter. It's funny how the Scottish campaign is remembered as a success down in London, because the way I see it, it turned a country ambivalent about separation into a SNP one-party state, but didn't quite win enough votes for the referendum. But the effect of that campaign was to get people to the other side of the fence. Now, this has made me remember the fact that not just in Britain, but in everywhere in Europe where a no campaign has triumphed, it's normally triumphed not because of great leadership, but because the other side was overselling its case. But because there were so many people, usually the government, the opposition, the trade unions, the employers' unions, all rally behind the yes vote to the extent where your average voter smells a rat. And there is such a thing as too much momentum. I think David Cameron was in danger of having it a few weeks ago. So he's now staring, amazed at the polls, thinking, but nobody's leading the out campaign. How can they possibly be ahead? But in referenda, you don't need anybody to lead the rejection of the notion.
James, do you agree with that, that actually the out campaign don't need a big beast? They seem quite preoccupied with the idea at the moment.
I think they do need a big beast, in that the out campaign is still not in a good place, because the general rule of thumb is that the change proposition in a referendum needs to be 10 points ahead before the campaign begins, and that the change proposition in this referendum is out, and it's not there yet. Mm. I think one of the other things is this, is that the best argument for the inside is the sheer disruption that would follow leaving the EU. That for several years, possibly as long as a decade, that's all we'd be doing. But I think David Cameron's undercut that argument, because he said, look, I join the EU tomorrow on these current terms. So I think, which I think doesn't work for Cameron, because he's trying to present himself in this national debate as the pragmatist, the person who's weighed up the cost, you know, cost benefit analysis. I think that makes him sound a bit too ideologically committed to in for voters like,
and also unconvincing. James, you think that David Cameron is undermining his own rationale?
Yeah. Because the thing that should give pause to people, it is how long it would take to extricate ourselves from the EU, how long it would take to negotiate our own trade agreements with other countries and the like. I think saying that you would choose to join the European Union suggests that you don't think those are the strongest arguments for your side, and suggests a level of commitment to the EU that I think goes beyond where the average voter is.
Fraser, if you were on the out campaign, what tactics would you deploy?
Well, on the out campaign, right now, keep quiet and hope the Prime Minister continues in this vein, really, which he seems capable of doing. But it's actually not that difficult to point to the continent and look at things going wrong. The migration crisis mutates and it gets ever worse. And it's a crisis which isn't just to do with the war in Syria, it's to do with the tragically inept response of at an EU level to this. We've got a new financial crisis bubbling away in Europe right now. I mean, Deutsche Bank is in massive amount of trouble. It looks like it's going to have to be bailed out by the German government. So on top of the migration crisis, you get a European crisis. And if you're in the out campaign, you just say to voters, do you really want to be part of this? Look, this is obviously something's going badly wrong. Britain, we're okay because we've got better bank regulation. And every single time we as a country have moved away from the European consensus, be it with rejecting the single currency or rejecting the Schengen borderless travel, it has been to our great advantage. So continue this theme, dear voters, and you can keep Britain safe and secure by steering well clear of what's happening on the continent.
I think one other thing that you'll hear a lot more from the out campaign is this case of Abu Hamza's daughter-in-law. You know, here you have got a Moroccan citizen convicted of trying to smuggle a SIM card into Britain's most secure jail to give to a man later convicted of multiple terrorism offences in the United States. And the European Court of Justice is blocking the Home Office from deporting this person. How is that fit with David Cameron's argument that being in the EU is making us more secure in the fight against terrorism?
But if I was advising Cameron just for arguments for staying in the EU, I'd be talking a lot more about the overall beauty of it. Like, here is something which unites a continent which used to be at war is something that gives every British citizen the right to go and live and work anywhere they want in Europe. The EU project is united around the four freedoms of movement, free trade. These are things which British people like. And I can't work out why he isn't selling what I regard as being the positive case for the EU, rather than trying to scare people on the negative effects of leaving. Again, just like the Scottish referendum campaign, that was nothing about the positive argument for the union and all about the negative aspects of leaving. It didn't work then, and I'm not sure it's going to work now. I mean, 2 weeks ago, I would have said David Cameron was overwhelmingly likely to win this referendum. Now, I really do think it's in the balance. And it's in the balance because of mistakes which the Prime Minister and the rest of the In campaign have made.
And James, do you think that the European Council summit next week, at which the deal is expected to be signed off, do you think there'll be any changes that help Cameron's cause? Or do you think that actually the referendum campaign is really not about the renegotiation anyway?
Well, I think they need to get off the renegotiation. I don't think there's enough in the renegotiation for them to help them out of that. I think the nightmare scenario for Cameron is that this deal gets diluted down at the European Council, which is a problem for them. Now, we know that Cameron has some rabbits that he intends to pull out of a hat, including one on sovereignty, which I think is fairly... I mean, I think Martin Howe, who is not very legal podcast today, but another QC who David Cameron himself put on this commission on a Bill of Rights. He is basically one of the people the government asked to look at the sovereignty law. He has written a piece basically saying all of this is meaningless. It doesn't do the job that it's, it doesn't do what it's meant to say on the tin.
So that won't bring any more Eurosceptics on
board? I don't think so.
I think
great irony of this is that the sovereignty law was meant to bind Boris Johnson and Michael Gove in to the In campaign. I think it's actually ending up making it more difficult for both of them to support the Prime Minister. Michael Gove, because as Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor, he looked at it, realised it didn't work, so he has this kind of intellectual problem in his head. And Boris Johnson, because it's a fig leaf, but it's a fig leaf that is going to rapidly blow away and not cover up very much at all, and that could leave him looking quite embarrassed in public.
So what do you expect those two to do then?
Well, I still think that Boris is more likely than not to end up backing in. I think his aim is to put all the pitfalls of the problems of a deal at George Osborne's door and indicate that he is very, very reluctantly, out of kind of loyalty to the Prime Minister, decided to back in, but, very grudgingly. I think Michael Gove is currently leaning slightly, the official line is that Michael Gove hasn't made up his mind. You talk to his friends, and it is a slight complication for Michael Gove, but he has a lot of friends. You talk to his friends, there is a sense at the moment in his social circle that he is now slightly leaning more towards out than in.
There's a question, of course, to how much this is going to matter for the public at large. I mean, does it really matter what Priti Patel thinks about this or Michael Gove?
I think it does. I think it matters in the following ways. First of all, it matters in terms of what newspapers do, which I think do have an effect on public opinion, as I would suggest if you look at these polls show. And I think the other thing is the Out campaign's got to not look like it's just UKIP on steroids, or that it's a bunch of people who want to take Britain back to the 1950s.
We've hardly heard from Nigel Farage so far in this campaign. And it's interesting, in Charles Murray's column this week in The Spectator, he points out that if Britain does vote out, there'll be no more need for Nigel Farage. And he couldn't handle that, which is why he isn't really campaigning for Out. Well, that's a prospect that Charles raises. But it's funny that I would have expected by now Farage to be the sort of face of the Out campaign, and that hasn't happened, which, of course, is to the great benefit of the Out campaign, which is definitely gaining ground.
That was James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson discussing the Prime Minister's arguments for why Britain should stay a part of the EU. And finally, the headlines in recent weeks have been filled with tragic tales of whales becoming stranded on Britain's beaches. In 2016 alone, 6 sperm whales have died on the shores of Norfolk and Lincolnshire. And it's a similar story across Europe, where a total of 30 sperm whales have been beached. What is causing these whales to become stranded? And why do the huge sea creatures inspire such delight and wonder in our imaginations? Simon Barnes writes in this week's Spectator that mankind has learned to love whales, and that in doing so, we've learned much about ourselves in the process. Joining Simon to discuss whales is Peter Evans, director of marine charity, the Sea-Watch Foundation. So, Simon, are more whales being beached on British beaches at the moment?
Well, there certainly seems to be a glut of it going on at the moment, and it's been extraordinary and really rather devastating to watch. Peter will certainly know more of that and just from the statistical and scientific aspect.
Peter, is it the case that more are getting washed up on beaches?
Well, not recently. From the 1980s, there was a big increase. So before that, there was less than one a year stranding in Britain. And now there's between 5 and 7 a year. But it's remained fairly stable since the 1980s. However, you know, these particular events like this mass stranding are pretty rare. We've only had, I think it's 13 since the 16th century with more than four animals or more. So that gives you some idea of the relative rarity of these bigger strandings.
What has caused this big stranding recently?
I think that it's almost certainly a sort of natural phenomenon. What has happened is that the sperm whales were probably feeding up in the Norwegian Trench, which is a deep trough that goes, you know, down to about 1,500 metres west of Norway. And there's a tongue of that that comes right into the North Sea. It's a good area for squid, for the genus Gonatus, which is quite a big squid. And it's a favoured prey of sperm whales. And it's the one that's been found in the stomachs of a lot of the animals that have been post-mortem now, the ones that first stranded, which did have quite a lot of squid in their stomachs. And I think what's probably happened is that as soon as they've moved further south and got south of the Dogger Bank, they get into much shallower waters there, you know, around 40 metres or less. And in fact, these strandings we've had in eastern England, France, Germany and Holland have all been really in waters adjacent to waters of less than 20 metres.
Right. And Simon, is there anything that can be done to stop so many whales getting beached?
Well, the thing about whales is that they are enormous and it's really hard to do anything other anything with a whale other than deal with the problem that you have on your hands. There are man-made causes that possibly affect strandings. And again, Peter will know a great deal more. But things like naval sonar, underwater explosions and problems associated with oil and gas exploration and noise pollution affecting the sonar that the whales use. Yes, certainly that can be used more sympathetically, sighted more sympathetically. But when you have got a whale that is getting blown towards the sea, drifting towards the land because it's ill or because it's suffered a navigational malfunction, then you have nothing but a problem. And in human terms these days, a very sad one.
Peter, how realistic is it for us to be able to change things like naval sonar? I mean, they're pretty important, aren't they, in order to stop whales from washing up on beaches?
Yes, I think that most of the evidence for negative effects from naval sonar have been on beaked whales, which is a much smaller whale than the sperm whale. And it just seems that for some reason it affects their behaviour, their dive pattern, and that the frequencies of that mid-frequency sonar, which are between 2 and 10 kilohertz, is close to what seems to disturb those whales. We haven't had much evidence that naval sonar affects sperm whales, though, which operate at a rather different frequency. But you can change things. You can get the Navy to operate in particular areas that are don't have some of these whale species very common. Although, unfortunately, beaked whales tend to overlap with the areas that the Navy likes to use, which are deep canyons. But there are some areas that they could adopt. And they could probably modify their sonar as well, technologically. So there are those things that can be done. But as I said, I don't think that's sort of related to this particular event.
Particular one. And is there nothing that can be done once the whale is on the beach? That's it. You have to wait for it to die? Or can a whale be rescued and got back into the water safely?
In the problem with these areas here is that it's very shallow sloping, and it's either sand or mud, and that's in fact why probably the whales themselves have difficulty because they can't use their sonar very easily to actually get a picture of their environment around them. But if they haven't sort of damaged themselves, you know, which is what tends to happen, there tends to be respiratory failure once these really big animals rest upon any harder substrate. But if they haven't done that, then potentially you could airlift them off. There's no point really in just pushing them a bit further out to sea, because the chances are they'll just strand a little bit along the coast, because the whole of that area is very shallow. But in America, they have airlifted large whales, and it's a big procedure. That would be the only solution, and that, you know, that's quite a practical challenge. And you would then have to take them, you know, up into the northern North Sea, really, for them to have much chance of survival. That's really what should have happened with the northern bottlenose whale, the famous one that went up the Thames. If they could have airlifted that out early on, I think when it was still relatively undamaged, they might have saved
it. Have been able to save it. And Simon, in your piece, you chart the way in which our attitudes towards whales have changed from just a sort of commodity that we can eat and use for oil to something that we love and book expensive holidays to go and see. But there are still countries, as you say in your piece, that are fishing for them using the cover of scientific purposes. Do you think that will eventually change as well, and that Japan and others will stop hunting whales?
At the moment, it's become a situation in which the whaling countries feel that they would lose too much face by backing down. And they've sort of painted themselves into a corner, and it's become very much an adversarial situation. But the thing about whaling is that it has become so almost universally agreed to be a bad thing, that to carry on whaling is basically putting on your flag a little badge that says we are an unenlightened nation, and Iceland, Norway, and Japan, the principal countries still involved in whaling, do have a certain stigma. And I think there will come a time when that will change, but as there are plenty of ways in which we are damaging whale populations without going to the trouble of killing them, and we're doing them by means of bycatch, by sound interference, by pollution, by ship strike, and by climate change. And so the banning of whaling in the holdout countries is not going to be by any means a final solution.
That was Simon Barnes and Peter Evans on whales. And that's it for this week's edition of The View from 22. Thank you for listening. And to listen to more of our podcasts, you can visit our website at www.spectator.co.uk/podcast. Alternatively, to listen to the podcast in iTunes, search under podcasts for The Spectator. And podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.
Gary, Winston Wolf, direct line. Your landlord Mike says you wrecked his place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with direct line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria in excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.